Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you, everyone who came. We're nearing the last stages of what has been a long and detailed process this year. Back at the very beginning, when the Seminary Dean Search Committee got together and started working, we held a number of listening sessions with a whole range of people, including, of course, seminary faculty, but also talking to local church leaders and church leaders in constituent conferences and students and staff and a long list of people who had a stake in this important decision of choosing a new seminary dean and EMU vice president. At the end of that process, I sent an email to the seminary faculty that summarized what I thought and what the committee felt were sort of four key themes that emerged out of those listening sessions of that described what it was we were looking for in the next VP and seminary dean. And let me just run down that list for you. There were four themes. The first was we wanted a serious scholar with a pastoral orientation. The second was someone who would, excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. The second was someone who would connect well with traditional Mennonite and Methodist congregations and also connect well with what became a kind of code phrase for us in the search, the church as it is becoming. That is, the whole set of movements and trends that are out there on the growing edges of the church today. The third was someone who would be able to engage a broad range of prospective students, both students who were looking for traditional pastoral ministry roles, but also students who were looking to seminary for other kinds of ministries or maybe simply for other kinds of professional and academic interests. Fourth was someone who would speak with a clear Anabaptist voice in conversation with our diverse Mennonite constituencies and with ecumenical partners. Now, that's a pretty difficult checklist. But I'm happy to say that I think we've found someone who actually fits those criteria quite well. And I'm happy to introduce to you today Michael King as our candidate of choice for this position. We think Michael meets these criteria, and in addition to that, we were very impressed in our conversations with him by his deep love for the church and his deep love for EMU and its mission. Let me say a little bit about his career so you know what it is he's bringing to us. He does have a pastoral orientation. He's served in pastoral roles in three different congregations in the Franconia Conference, Germantown Mennonite Church, Salford Mennonite Church, and Springmount Mennonite Church. And if you know the Franconia Conference, those congregations represent about as broad a range of who Mennonites are in that region of the world as is possible. And he had a successful pastor at each one of those places. His academic life has been primarily in the publishing world. He worked for a number of years for Herald Press, and now, as many of you know, heads Cascadia Publishing House, a company that he founded, which focuses on Anabaptist and Mennonite-related publications that are targeted to scholarly and educated audiences. Is that a fair description? He has some adjunct teaching experience both at Messiah Temple and at our seminary program in Lancaster. He's been the editor or co-editor of three books and the author of three others. The book that has probably captured the most attention and critical acclaim that some of you may be familiar with is called Trackless Wastes and Stars to Steer By, Christian Identity in a Homeless Age. And I think that title captures a lot of what Michael's scholarly interests and career have revolved around. He has a long series of professional and popular articles and book chapters in a variety of venues. He's an EMU alum, graduated here with his bachelor's in 76, and received an MDiv from what is now Palmer Theological Seminary, what was then Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary, in 1982, and received a PhD in 1998 from Temple University in rhetoric and communication. And for those of you who know anything about his predecessor's history, you might recognize that that's the same degree that Irvin Stutzman held. In fact, they both had the same dissertation directors. We think this isn't nepotism, but following in good footsteps. He's here today with his wife, Joan, who's also an EMU alum, and their parents of three daughters, all of whom are or soon will be EMU graduates. So they have a long history with this institution. Michael's going to speak for a half hour, 40 minutes, and we hope to have plenty of time at the end for questions, answers, conversation. I will make an advance warning that I'm going to hustle him out of here really quickly at noon for the next meeting. We have him scheduled pretty much back-to-back all day long with different groups of people. So if he doesn't have time to hang around and converse afterwards, you can blame that on me. But do take advantage of the Q&A time to engage with Michael as much as you can. Please welcome me in joining Michael King.
Thank you, Fred. I think you gave that list of background better than I could. Well, I need to kind of set the stage for who I am, and some of you will recognize this story because you experienced it. Sun shining, birds chirping, people happy to be alive. I feel it too. School for leadership training has gone well. I just need to drop off the SLT presenter expense form at the EMS front desk. Then, things get a little dicey. My car is parked out right down where the doors are, the main doors are, except that the operative tense is was parked. My Dodge Colt is drifting downhill. I try to stop it desperately, you know, just try to hold the thing back against the impulse of gravity, but I soon realize I have a choice, which is to leap or die. The Colt jumps the curb down by the seminary sign. The shock of the curb pops open the driver door, and it pops open just as it passes. There's got to be meaning here somewhere, just as it passes by the Eastern Mennonite Seminary sign. So glass explodes, the sign yanks off the door, the car keeps going down toward, it looks like, the EMU library and then points beyond, maybe, Interstate 81. But God is good. A sturdy oak tree. I have to go see where it is someday and just really pin this down. A sturdy oak tree planted by someone who foresaw this day stands firm. The back bumper curves gracefully around the tree. All is still. People filter out. They gawk, awe-stricken at the crash scene. Some of you may have been there. I remember one wonderful Good Samaritan went back into his apartment, got duct tape, brought it back, and we duct taped my car door back on. And I drove that blasted out door and car back to Pennsylvania. Well, I begin with that report to ensure that if I'm confirmed as dean, it's as who I am. Not who I'm not. Who I am is someone who makes mistakes. People who know me know this, and you should know it too. When I told Don McDonough, the associate pastor with whom I worked at Springmount Mennonite, about this visit, he was tickled. Then came an email. The email just said, "Parking brake." And when I opened it up, it said, "Be sure to use your parking brake." Because this is a famous legend at Springmount. We make mistakes, and we learn from them. We learn to use the parking brake. We learn to repair what we have broken. We grow. We become wiser. Not because we never blew it, but often because we blew it. The point isn't to make mistakes. I can tell you I hope never to watch another car hit the EMS sign. The point is that as bad as their consequences can be, mistakes embraced can offer treasure. This is gospel. God be merciful to me, a sinner. For you and I have sinned. We haven't measured up to the glory of God. We've forgotten in more ways than we can count to put on the parking brake. And yet, here we sit, each of us. And I suspect many of us are sitting here because how true it is that laced throughout scriptures, the Jesus stories, the writings of Paul, is the amazing word of grace. The word that our healing, our strengths, our ability to minister in the name of Christ are interwoven precisely with the mistakes that humble us, that open our souls to our need for more, that make us, faced with Jesus' love, kneel at his feet, splashing them with tears. Let me share then early glimpses of a vision I might bring to EMS as dean and how it's rooted in mistakes and parking brake learnings. I'll tell of two congregations and a temple. The first congregation, as Fred mentioned, is Germantown Mennonite Church. My wife Joan and I left here in 1979. We moved out from where is now Virginia Mennonite Retirement Community. We lived on what I think is the last house that was standing there before it was torn down for all that complex of things. And we left to go to Philadelphia, where I studied at Eastern Baptist and, as Fred said now, Palmer Theological Seminary. I went as the committed follower of Jesus. I had become here at EMU, but full of questions. I went because, amid a lifetime of faith wrestlings, what I really cared about, I struggled with faith, but what I really cared about was the meaning of life and of God. I remember, as many of us do in our own ways, a night of walking down South College Avenue to my apartment. An EMU senior gazing up at the stars in a night so clear it seemed I could see to the end of the universe. I so wanted to see through to God on the other side, but I couldn't tell if I did. I took that yearning to seminary, not to become a pastor, which I was determined not to be, but to see how far through that star-spangled translucence I could travel. Then graduation approached. Seminary had helped my heart and head knit together, and at times even blaze with faith, but I still didn't want to be a pastor. God, though, works sometimes through mundane circumstances, and the fact was that I needed a job. Roman and Mariana Stutzman, an older couple at Germantown Mennonite, a congregation where Roman was on the pastoral team, said they believed God was telling them I should become their pastor and that Joan and I should bring ourselves and our one-year-old daughter, Christy, there. The congregation's 25 participants were struggling. After seeking to live out a radical Anabaptist commitment to the priesthood of all believers by using lay leaders as a pastoral team, they were debating whether, in effect, to betray their values and call for the first time in maybe a generation a paid pastor. Joan and I conferred with my uncle Richard Detwaller, a trusted mentor. Germantown, he said, is struggling and complicated. We had the option of going up to Lakeview in rural North Pennsylvania. Go there, said Richard. But Roman and Mariana were persuasive. We were drawn to service in a multicultural, often African-American, urban context. That's why we'd moved to Philadelphia. We'd gone there because here we'd heard Vincent Harding talk about how important it was for Mennonites to be in cities. And so we were there because of what Vincent had told us, and we decided we needed to continue that, to honor that vision, and so we leaped. And the Germantown saga began. I was only 27, but thought I knew some things. Those of you who are now 27 do know some things. I knew less than I thought I did. I began to preach a radical grace. I shared dreams of a church more like what we now call emergent. I forget how you put it, Fred, the church becoming. Dreams of a community marked by authenticity, openness to questions, fewer rules, and more passion. Throughout Philadelphia were scattered many Mennonites like us, often from traditional backgrounds, yet feeling exiled from them in urban studies and jobs. The word spread that new things were happening at Germantown, and months' attendance had doubled and more, not simply due to my role, but because sparks were spreading from person to person and group to group. The networks were activated. For a shining moment, we seemed to be living again in Acts 2, whereby the countless numbers were added converts. As we broke bread in each other's homes, as we eagerly studied the Bible, not just in the ways of our childhoods, but as if it were our own book, written for our challenges and questions, as we told about who we really were, rather than what church people are supposed to be, the Holy Spirit seemed to flame on our heads and a rushing wind to envelop us all. But the pastor hadn't fully understood how to put on the parking brake. I had been hired to serve a group that wanted pastors not to lead from on high, and I myself had been shaped in the anti-authoritarian 60s and 70s, so I pastored too much as friends. I poured my energies into relationships at an unsustainable level. In various ways, my pastoral car was jumping the curb. I began more clearly to understand why Vince DeGregoris, my seminary professor of pastoral care, had taught that pastors need to be among the people, but also wear a mantle. Now, if any of you think that sounds a little bit concerning, Vince was a Baptist, an American Baptist. So I was corrupted in seminary. I began to realize that I didn't mean that, for those of you who are Baptists. I married an American Baptist, wherever she is, right there. I began to realize that for my and my congregation's health, I'd need to find my pastoral mantle. I'd need to learn how to be more than my congregant's friend. I'd need to take more seriously Vince's teachings that a pastor can be a real person and a professional, close in spirit to the people, but also able. In those moments, people need not friend, but priest, to be a channel for the healing presence of God. You know, a speaker whose manuscript gets out of order needs to pause for a minute. I may have to ad-lib for a while. I'm perfectly capable of ad-libbing, but ad-libbing is a little different than the other style of presentation. One, two, three, four, six. Guys, there's a page missing here. Okay, what will the Lord want me to say here? So moving on, let's see where we're supposed to be here. Basically, what I wanted to say in the missing page is that what I learned in that setting, in that experience of needing to put on the pastoral mantle, was part of what I think a seminary needs to be oriented toward teaching. I see a seminary in today's becoming church as needing to be aware, on the one hand, of precisely the kind of passionate opening up of the church that we experienced at Germantown, how the Holy Spirit moves among us here and now, today, and at the same time. And I think this is the level at which we do it, is typically at seminary. At the same time, to learn how the norms and ethics and professional expectations of professional life, of professional understandings of ministry, can be not only a curse, as some polities and my wilder self were convinced back in the 1980s, but also a blessing. And I share that piece of the Germantown experience in relation to EMS because that is one of the things that will shape me. It doesn't mean that who I am if I become dean should override what you teach, what you believe, what you already do here in terms of your vision as pastoring, but at least you know some of the directions I would set and why. And that experience back there is one of the very formative experiences for me. The belief that we do church in a way that is just so much more wide open than we've been used to doing it, and yet that we do it in a way that does have a kind of professional set of understandings, ethics, and skills. Church number two was Spring Mount Mennonite. And Spring Mount was an entirely different congregation than Germantown Mennonite Church. As Fred rightly put it, Germantown, probably at the farthest edge theologically and culturally and urban city-wise of Franconia Mennonite Conference. And Spring Mount maybe not entirely at the opposite edge, but a totally different congregation, semi-lost in the little village of Springmount, semi-rural context. I preached most Sundays, but I did find out why sometimes when I was preaching, people would seem to get kind of, when I didn't preach and I would be in the pews and experience it, I would see why people would sometimes get lost in my preaching, because they were over there watching them make snow on Springmount, where the ski slopes could be visibly observed while the sermon was unfolding in winter. So a completely different context. And I remember that when the denominational leader who asked me if I would consider going to Spring Mount wanted to know if I would do it, he, on the one hand, was opening up the door, but on the other hand, he was hesitant. He said, "It's not Germantown, you know. Totally different kind of place. The people who go here are often really traditional Mennonites." And I said, "Well, you know, in some ways, the Germantown years stereotyped me. People see me as who they think Germantown was and is, and I don't mean to negate that. But on the other hand, I'm more than that. And part of what I'm passionate about now," I told this denominational leader, "is not only the radical edge of the church, but how in these times when cultural change is eroding the very core of the church, how do we rebuild the center of the church? How do we refine the stabilities and ballasts that even in the middle of church becoming are so essential to the health of the church?" Within that, I said, I was excited about looking for Jesus at Spring Mount. So I went to Spring Mount, and Spring Mount turned out to be not Germantown, but there also was a sense of deja vu in that this was another struggling congregation. Participants were leaving, lest they sink with the ship. Attendance had quickly dwindled to mid-50s. I was to help the congregation discern whether we could turn things around or should plan a dignified burial. There was a great gift, though, lurking in this near death. Backs were against the wall. Either change or perish, people knew. That was liberating. If odds are good that you'll go to your own funeral soon, you might as well try things you'd not ordinarily be open to and have fun along the way. So we tested things. We declared an experiment in the spirit. We didn't want to scare ourselves to death, so we agreed after X period we'd evaluate. But during the experiment, the rule was no idea too crazy. Let the spirit's winds blow. Among things the experiment helped us name was that we were made up of the pizza and the shoe fly gangs. Many of us came from that time-honored Pennsylvania Dutch shoe fly pie loving world. My parents live down here in Virginia Mennonite Retirement Community, and whenever I come down, my mom wants me to bring her shoe fly pie. But we needed people who loved pizza, a more common craving in our surrounding Springmount area. So we looked for ways to become more pizza-friendly, including by hosting lunches of literal pizza, in which we kept brainstorming. This led to experiments like trying worship in a local fire hall instead of the sanctuary, and ultimately hiring Don, a pizza guy himself, to be our associate pastor and complement my shoe flyness. I make them myself. After flirting at times with 70s during my tenure there, when I left Springmount, attendance was hovering in the 50s and 60s. The congregation seemed much farther from burial, but even as most of us felt warmed by ways God had worked among us, we were still hungry for more people and resources. And as part of your knowing who I really am, I left, not because it was failing, but because I told the congregation I felt I'd done all I knew to do. It was time for somebody who had still different visions and understandings and gifts to take it to the next stage. I didn't know what else to do to get to the next stage. I'm not sure why gaining strength was such hard work, but I'd guess at three things. First, we never quite managed to tap into a network that just blazed with excitement and brought the seekers flooding in. I think this whole issue of how we tap networks is one that seminaries need to be pondering. Second, we were inevitably an odd little church, this mix of Mennonites, many of whom had once even worn coverings and plain coats, and others of us who barely knew what a Mennonite was. I sure think that's a dynamic seminaries need to be pondering when the context is Mennonite. I know, Dan, totally different set of issues in the UMC, and those are important too. Third, many of us had been so bruised by life, whether by age, disease, mental illness, or drug and alcohol addictions, that often success was mere survival, not explosive growth. Amid that final reality, the bruised by life reality, I came to believe the parking brake Springmount taught us was that those of us excited, as we should be, I resonate with the longings that Fred indicates for the future of EMS. But as we became ever better at those kinds of things, we realized that the emergent and missional church trends need to shape not just movements, but walls of congregational homes. At times, emergent and missional emphases risk tearing down church walls without adequately rebuilding or sustaining needed ones. This became evident to me in my final years at Springmount. As Springmount became ever better at truly showing itself a home for those seeking forgiveness of brokenness, sins, forgotten parking brakes, more and more participants arrived with deep wounds. The most searing event came one January. Debbie, who gave me permission to share this, I had called her Sandy, but I told her what I was up to. She said, "I don't want you to call me, I do want you to share it, but call me by my real name, because that would bless my heart." Debbie had long struggled with alcohol and substance abuse mixed with depression and anxiety. One day, as she was feeling suicidal, she met a Springmount Mennonite member. The member invited her to church. She came and gradually felt herself adopted into our wing of the body of Christ. She found considerable healing, but her wounds were also great. So she spent weeks rotating between this treatment clinic and that. On a Tuesday, she was to be discharged. Her daughter, Jessica, was to pick her up that morning. Then came the news. Jessica, a recovering addict herself, had gone with a friend to Philadelphia. They got drugs. Jessica died that morning of an overdose. I met Jessica in the funeral home, where I glimpsed the beauty even in her dead face as her mother wept beside me. That day just pounded into me the conviction that whatever we call them, we will still always need something like what we now call congregations, whatever the specifics of how we view their mantles. We will always need something like what we now call pastors. Debbie needed her friends, her family, the staff at the clinic. She also needed someone she could call her pastor, and even, if I dare stretch Anabaptist emphases, her priest. I dream of seminary as a place to learn about such things, to learn how, as we rightly experiment with new ways of doing church, of doing outreach, of being present in the often postmodern currents of a fast-changing world, we open up the life of the church. A seminary can provide countless courses on how congregations might run experiments of the Spirit to become more hospitable homes to Debbie. And if we don't do that, the church becoming will not become. I mean, that is the future of the church. A seminary also needs to be a training center within which, even as we remodel church structures, we take seriously that sometimes the clinic will call. Please come now. Your parishioner's daughter is dead. Debbie is pleading for you. Then we need to have trained our ministers to have a clue what to do. Finally, a temple, meaning Temple University. I chose to get my PhD in rhetoric and communication at Temple after debating whether to study homiletics at Princeton. But I had spent my entire life in the church here at Eastern Baptist in my congregational settings, looking out at the world. What would happen if from out in the world I looked in at the church? So I chose Temple. Here for the first time, I studied, and I remember being terrified of this, but it was worth it. I studied in a setting within which Christianity wasn't assumed. Many of you, some of you, I know many of you sitting here, many of you are my mentors. Many of you were out there doing this a generation or two before I was, but this was my experience in the 1990s. All my key mentors at Temple were likely agnostics, though I experienced each as life-giving. I was pretty sure what Cindy Patton, then making a name for herself in queer studies, was saying through that hint of a grin when she'd look at her Mennonite pastor student. It was something like, well, maybe there is a God. Otherwise, how did we two end up here together? And Dan, I don't know what it means, but her grandfather was a UMC, prior denominational configuration pastor. She had completely rejected the church, but that was her inheritance. At Temple, I came to two conclusions. First, at least based on that setting, academia isn't primarily a place for Christians to fear. We often worry what postmodernist tendencies will do because they foster a relativism in which any truth is as good as another. And I agree that can be a danger. It's something we do have to watch out for. But what I experienced at Temple is that the breakdown of old Enlightenment convictions that human reason is capable of knowing all truth has left wonderful space for people of faith to flourish in. At Temple, my Christianity was not privileged. I couldn't say, this is true because the Bible says it. Cindy Patton doesn't care if I say, well, but what about 1 Corinthians 13? That is not the realm of discourse that we're engaging in. At the same time, we all had to make our cases. As 1 Peter 3:15 puts it, we had to be ready to defend the hope in us. But all of us, Christian or not, had our place at the table. So I dream of a seminary excited about connecting students with this intellectual feast. Christians are welcome. Let our scholarships, our insights, our tendency, our footnotes scattered out across the academic journals and books be part of the entire feast, secular and interfaith and more. Not primarily a snack for invitees only in a side room named Christian. My second temple conclusion was that studying outside the church could make me a better Christian. Study can hurt faith. I don't mean to minimize that whole possibility, but if we see faith less as a frail thing in a cloistered garden, and more as the oak tree that stopped my car at the brink, academia can call forth from faith untold riches. I'm indebted, for instance, to Michel Foucault, who, though by no means living my values, was a passionate seeker of truth. And in writings like Discipline and Punish, or What is an Author?, helped me encounter with fresh joy the faith an author like Frederick Buechner offers in The Alphabet of Grace, a book showing how the ordinary is shot through with holiness. My dissertation revolved around Hans-Georg Gadamer, making me look afresh at Jesus' teaching to love enemies. Gadamer deepened my asking, what would it look like in these polarized times in which we're tempted to hate the person who holds the viewpoint we love, to practice loving the enemies we make even of Christian brothers and sisters with whom we disagree. The parking break is important here in two ways. Certainly, seminaries need a scholarship break, the critical function. In my publishing work, I apply the break, for example, against scholarship that treats the kingdom Jesus announces and nations of this world as the same thing, that confuses a country to which we pledge allegiance here with that far-off country yearned for in Hebrews 11. I'm also suggesting Christian faith is strong enough to allow seminaries to engage academia not only with parking brake on, though that's part of it, but also when we release it to feel those sweet desert breezes in our faces as we take a road trip in pursuit of the God lurking in the red rocks and canyons of scholarship. I'm only a dean candidate. If confirmed, I'll be a dean in training, needing to learn, among other things, what is already flourishing at EMS. I can't fully know now what vision should guide EMS. I need to know, if I'm confirmed, what is the center of the seminary's life and how do I join it, and not just pretend to know what should be done before joining it and experiencing and taking in the gifts already in motion. I can only point some directions. Let me quote directions in closing I shared with Cascadia authors. As owner of Cascadia Publishing House, I needed to assure that if I become dean, Cascadia will go on, even as my Cascadia role shrinks. In sharing the news with authors, I said the following. Drawing me in this unexpected direction is the conclusion that EMS is already in the midst of a transformative process. I was moved by the ways I heard the seminary search committee wrestling with and owning and wanting to find ways to move forward into the future of EMS. As publisher, my vision has included helping authors such as yourselves articulate the power to change church and world of core Christian and Anabaptist convictions placed passionately, creatively, fearlessly, and in bridge-building ways in conversation with today's ferment in faith and culture. Similarly, I understand EMS to be eager to work with a dean interested in contributing to an EMS known for A, rigorous training in traditional as well as emergent church skills, and B, shaping thought leaders, ready to plunge with excitement and appreciation for diverse theological starting points, cultures, and faith traditions into an era whose cross currents are sometimes unsettling or frightening, but also hold great opportunity and even potential for joy. I'd hope to help shape an EMS able to engage the largest questions and faith affirmations in trust that, as my Uncle Richard Detweiler used to tell me, when I'd take him my wrestlings, Jesus is as big as the universe. I'm keeping my hand close to the parking brake, but I look forward to learning where our mutual interests in the future of Eastern Mennonite Seminary, the Jesus we follow, and God's great universe may take us next. Fred suggested we take some time for Q&A. We have just a little bit under 20 minutes. I know Fred's going to hustle me. I don't want to say much more. If you do ask me things, I'll try to keep my answers very short. I do welcome questions, but also what's sparked for you in what you've heard. Part of my training, if I do become dean, is going to be to do a lot of listening, a lot of hearing from you. What are you experiencing as staff, faculty, students, constituents, and where does EMS go from here in terms of your dreams and hopes and visions? So let's see if there is a kind of outburst of comment here. I'd be glad for it. If you would like to talk now, I will shut up. Ted Grimsard, it would be you. Welcome.
Good to have you here. I'm struggling with whether I should ask this question or not, but I decided that it's important to get out of the table now rather than later. The narrow question, the big question, the narrow question is, I seem to remember that you said at one time you thought Teatro was a better record than Red-Headed Stranger.
If you think that's a trick question, it ain't gonna work. I've been on Ted's Facebook site, and I can't tell you how many hours I have not wasted, but treasured, because my iPod playlist it has expanded by, I don't know, about 300, and Amazon's got $300 more dollars because of Ted's playlist. But the serious thing lurking in there, Ted, is for me, the kinds of music I experience both of us as loving is the kind of thing I was talking about at the beginning. We are broken. We are hurting. We need forgiveness. We need meaning. I just sit there listening to that music, and my soul comes alive because it speaks to that.
My name is Jeremy Yoder, and I'm graduating this spring. And one of the things that has emerged in conversation with like our conference minister is that bivocational positions are the future of the church. That as Christianity loses, you know, the position of privilege, and MCUSA continues with membership issues, congregations aren't necessarily going to be able to afford full-time pastors. How do you see the role of the seminary in preparing us for that kind of situation?
Jeremy Yoder, you said? Well, one thing I would say is I have never not been a bivocational pastor, so I totally agree with you. I have never in my entire nearly 30 years of pastoring not had another job with it. How the seminary exactly works with that, I need to learn more before I think through the seminary side of it. I think Mark Wenger in the Lancaster Extension is already working at that in powerful ways, and I want to keep hearing from Mark some of how Mark's extension is blazing the trail here, because as I understand what you're doing, Mark, I think just about everybody who studies at Lancaster is already in some other setting. So even at the time that they are doing seminary training, they're also in pastoral assignments or various ministry assignments. Is that a fair, quick survey? So In brief, I guess I'd say, Jeremy, that somehow we're going to have to learn the flexibility of how we schedule seminaries, both to honor the fact that even the student experience is bivocational, and then also probably we need to be doing some intentional thinking about the reality that often seminary students are not going to get assignments that are full-time with benefits and the whole package comes with it. My own feeling is that there are downsides to that. My dear wife, Joan, has spent our entire 25 to 30 years working harder than I wish she had because I've been bivocational. So we've got to address it. But I also think if we can do it intentionally, we can look at some of the richness of that. I loved the bivocationality because it always meant I had a grounding in the real world. The church is the real world, but in a different way. I had a grounding in the real world while I was pastoring. My first pastorate, I fixed homes. I would go down to Philadelphia. I would fix homes for a company down there, clean toilets, clean carpets, and think through my sermons. That was, for me, life-giving. Others of you.
My name is Roger. I'm a new student at the seminary this January. I'm Episcopalian, and I want to thank you for your definition of ministry, which stretches to include the sacramental and understanding of that part of our mission in the body. Thank you.
And I thank you and those of you who have held that sacramental understanding, because I needed to learn from it. I am an Anabaptist. You know, Fred rightly said the dean should be an Anabaptist. I am, but I have learned an awful lot from the sacramental side of things, and I thank you folks in your traditions.
And I'm here to experience the other half of that partnership.
Wonderful.
Michael, I don't think it's been mentioned that you've also edited and published a magazine for the last number of years.
True.
Seeker. And I guess I'd be curious for you to say a little bit about, you've published a variety of more young writers, young voices in that magazine. But then you too, as a writer, that's an important part of, I think, your vocation as well. So maybe could you say a little bit about both of those things, you as a writer, as well as how you've tried to nurture other writers?
It's a kind of spotty journey for me, because I started out wanting to be a novelist. I mean, my dream was to write novels. So writing is in me. But where I've ended up in my life so far, I always dreamed that, well, now, it used to be I'm going to start my novel when I'm 50. That didn't work. Maybe when I'm 70, 80, whatever. But for now, I've seen writing, and this is why I went to get training in rhetoric and communication. I am not a postmodernist in the sense that I believe that God's truth and reality is not there for us to somehow connect with. I do take seriously what I was trained in my rhetoric program to understand, which is that words, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. They have tremendous power to create realities. And so what I hope to do with writing is to have the values and passion and soul that I use words for create realities that are appropriate to my Christian commitments. That's part of what I hope for when I work with other writers. So as you know, the tagline of my magazine is Dream Seeker Magazine, Voices from the Soul. And what I'm always looking for is, where is your soul speaking? Where is something happening in the reality that you are creating with your words that touches and springs from the soul? How that connects then into seminary life is a whole other range of issues, but I sure care about it, and I think that it certainly has a tremendous impact on seminary in that the act of preaching is right smack in the thick of all of that. Scholarship in its own way can be poetry from the soul and should be. So I guess I would shut myself up with too many words here other than to say I think that words are amazingly powerful. The Bible tells us that in many ways they're the tool God uses to create creation itself. So we're participating in that. How can a seminary not be vitally in the midst of that flow? And I can't resist saying one of the Dream Seeker magazine authors is Laura Amstutz, and the poor woman needs to try to not get me to be a dean because I can't wait to work with her and see what we can do together.
I find my voice there. Don speaking, one of the librarians.
Yes, Don.
As a publisher, I'm obviously at the dynamic days in terms of publishing both journals and books. What do you see as the future? Where is this going?
Important. Matt, I think it was. You're podcasting this presentation, right? And there's digitalization and electronification of communication just going bonkers out there. As a publisher, I am both thrilled by it and terrified by it because it's happening so fast. Like in books, I love... This is what is called a book, for those of you who are still in the know. I'm conservative enough to say, what was wrong with it? You know, this was a perfect solution to the problem. Why are you inventing another solution to the problem that's already been solved? But people are going in that direction. I'm trying to keep up with it on the publishing side, but you can't even figure out what the e-book standards are because there's a million of them. All I know at the moment is it's happening. We're in the thick of it. Seminaries are certainly going to be impacted by it. You're seeing it in library work. I'm saddened by it. To me, it's a great loss. I love books the way they are. Flip side is, I certainly don't want to be in 20 years unable to talk to anybody because I refuse to digitalize. So I think we're going to have to keep up with it. We're going to have to figure out how God is speaking in the midst of digital. But the best I can say right now is I think it's a time of chaos, ferment, and opportunity and sorrow all mixed together. Does that touch at all what you're thinking? Dave, yes.
I was struck by your comment that you want a seminary to be a place that prepares leaders for the emerging church as well as the traditional churches. There are 300,000 at least congregations in this country, most of which I would describe as traditional. You seem to have a passion for bringing everyone with you. How would you see the seminary embracing the emerging movement of the church that is becoming, not abandoning the church that it is?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say is I know I was combining emphases, but I really wanted to be heard as saying I believe that there are things the traditional church has been doing, is doing, that is like this. You know, some of what the traditional church is doing is still the best thing to be doing. So I don't hear me as saying, as passionate as I am about emergent and missional, I'm not out here to hope that seminaries stop serving the traditional. I actually think that's tremendously important. And I'll be disappointed if seminaries no longer have that mission. I'll be disappointed if the traditional church ceases to exist. To me, that'll be a tragedy. So the best I can say in a brief response here, Dave, is I would hope a place like EMS would be right in the thick of asking exactly your question. You know, we need to be doing both. We need to somehow be opening up the things that aren't working, which a lot of them aren't. I mean, when people sit in church and they're totally bored to death, and I don't want to cast aspersions on my background, but I didn't know when I was growing up that church was potentially fun or life-giving. Didn't work for me at all. A lot of people have that experience. So we got to address that. But on the flip side, at Safford Mennonite, where we attend now, I cannot tell you how many deaths and needs and justice causes have been addressed in services just in the last 3 weeks where I could just feel God alive in the midst of that, sort of on the edge between traditional and opening up. We got to somehow do it all, and I hope the right answer for a seminary is we're in the thick of everything, and we need faculty and students who are surveying the terrain and figuring out how we do what needs to be done here, here, and here. But I can't tell you it should all be done a certain way. I think Fred will shut me up in 3 minutes. Is that about right? Is that Myron Augsburger? Hi, Myron.
I speak for the older generation here just to say thank you. Thank you for the vision and perspective, Rebecca.
Thank you, Myron. That means a lot. Thank you. That truly means a lot.
That may be a good note to close on.
Okay.